And I got to say, yeah, no kidding. It's 2% of all venture capital went to female founders in the last 3 years, right? Do you think that's a statistical anomaly, or do you think that maybe something's going on with bias?
At some point, there's going to be this critical mass of founders that, you know, are getting good experience and they just start leaving for the coast.
That's right.
And then they're going to start looking around at each other and say, why wasn't that deal brought to me? I mean, it's gotten extreme, right? I mean,
it's gotten extreme. Yeah.
It's gotten extreme.
We don't need to be taking our own personal rockets to the moon.
That's right. We can argue on that. I like the space movement. I like space.
It's one of my values, both personally and part of the values of the company, is to be somebody that I needed to see when I was growing up. Like, so be that authentic person, be as weird and gay and audacious as I possibly can be.
Welcome back to the Middle Tech Podcast. You got Logan Jones and Evan Knowles here today. This is our first recording out of the Hunsicker Venture Studio here, and we're excited to be joined by Mandy Ralston of Non-Binary Solutions. So before we get into this conversation with Mandy, we want to get a quick word from our sponsors.
Before highlighting our sponsors, we'd just like to state that the views and content shared on this platform do not necessarily reflect those of our show sponsors. Middle Tech is presented by KY Innovation, the Kentucky Cabinet for Economic Development's Office of Entrepreneurship. KY Innovation exists to support and develop Kentucky's startup ecosystem, and we are proud to be supported by an organization whose mission aligns so closely with ours. If you're a founder building in Kentucky, you need to check out the resources that KY Innovation has to offer. You can find more information by clicking the link in our show notes or going to kyinnovation.com.
Middle Tech is sponsored by Bolt Marketing. Take your website to the next level with a website that's built to work. At Bolt Marketing, they're revolutionizing websites for small businesses that are affordable, customizable, and hassle-free. Whether you have a construction company, a boutique clothing store, or you own a hot yoga studio, they have options for you. Click the link in our show notes to explore their marketing options that can transform your marketing and grow your business. And as a personal note, Bolt Marketing built our website, and they were awesome to work with throughout the entire process. We highly recommend working with.
Middle Tech is also sponsored by Gotenna, the world's leading mobile mesh networking provider that's revolutionizing how first responders and defense teams stay connected during critical missions in austere or comms-denied environments. They partner with Kentucky's defense tech innovators, ensuring secure and reliable off-grid connections. If you're a founder looking to enhance your technology's communication capabilities for off-grid operations, Gotenna is looking to collaborate. Check them out at go.gotenna.com/middletech or reach out to us to get connected.
Middle Tech is also supported by Hunsicker, an impact venture studio based in Lexington, Kentucky. Hunsicker is creating companies out of the ordinary by founding and funding the next generation of purpose-driven startups. They partner with founders to create indispensable solutions to the world's most fundamental problems. On a quarterly basis, they host an invite-only intimate gathering called Fireside Convos, where attendees representing a wide network of stakeholders in the regional entrepreneurial ecosystem discuss timely topics, including the role of AI for startups out of Kentucky and the challenges of identifying and attracting talent. To be considered as a guest, visit huntsicker.co/fireside to apply.
All right, Mandy, welcome to Middle Tech Podcast. We're glad to finally be connecting with you here. I feel like you've been all over the place, winning pitch competitions. You've got a very good brand on social. So glad we could finally sit down and talk about Non-Binary Solutions.
I'm very glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So let's just kick off the conversation here by establishing this field that you're in. So I had it written down here, did a little bit of research on it, applied behavioral analysis.
Yes.
So first off, for anybody that might not understand what that is, just kind of describe what the field is and why you got into it in the first place.
So applied behavior analysis is an offshoot of psychology, specifically from behavioral psychology and operant conditioning. So B.F. Skinner was sort of the father of operant conditioning and behavioral psychology. He started off with lots of experiments related to rats in a cage and pigeons in a box and understanding how organisms behave under certain schedules of reinforcement and punishment. And so that's called an experimental analysis of behavior. So nobody's particularly concerned about what the rats and pigeons are doing. But if we take the principles that we've learned from those experiments and apply them to things that have social significance, then it becomes applied behavior analysis rather than experimental analysis of behavior. And so we take the principles that we learn from the experiments and then we apply them to things that matter to people, such as how to teach somebody to tie their shoes under a certain schedule of reinforcement, or quit smoking, or increase exercise, or communicate, or for large organizations, how to make them more efficient operationally. So that's applied behavior analysis.
And you've been in the field for a while now. Talk about your background in it and kind of establish that expertise for the audience on, you know, how long you've been. You've had an exit. So walk through all of that.
Yeah, so I first got started with ABA therapy, applied behavior analysis, back in 1999. I wrote a research paper while I was at Center College because my abnormal psychology book told me that it was one in every 1,000 individuals were diagnosed with autism. So I was curious enough, wanted to write a paper about it. I found seven families here in Lexington that were cobbling together these ABA programs by flying a consultant out from California once a quarter and teaching their family members and independent contractors that were high school students and college students to become these therapists or technicians to make these programs happen. And so I got interested. I started working with those seven families. I very quickly became sort of latched on with the idea of being able to teach people to communicate through play and science. And so I learned about certification and initially got my certification in 2002. My exam was taken on a Scantron with a number two pencil.
I remember those.
Yeah, right.
I was around for that.
And my supervision that I did in order to sit for that exam included me sending VHS tapes back and forth in the mail and talking on a landline with my mentor, Dr. Vincent Carbone. So I'm one of the dinosaurs at the field at this point. I was one of the first 1,500 certified behavior analysts at that time. And now there are 65,000 of them. And that's been a 500% increase in the providers in the last 10 years. And over half of the field has less than 5 years of experience.
Is that because autism is growing, or is there more awareness? And so we're realizing that there's actually autism is more frequent than maybe originally expected, or what's the growth?
Yeah. Well, this is going to be the first time in many you hear me say this. It's not binary. There's lots of different things going on that is causing the increase in autism. So it is, yes, greater awareness, lack of stigma. There's actually services available now. There are providers available now. There is now mandated insurance coverage in all 50 states. And so all of those things create a flywheel where you get more diagnosis, more providers, more services.
And just from a behavioral standpoint, I feel like all of us are familiar in some ways with autism, but from your perspective, from a clinical perspective, what exactly is autism, just for the audience?
Yeah, that has changed over time itself. In 1980, the DSM-3 came out. That's the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, and that's how you get all of the different diagnoses from psychology and psychiatry, right? It's all checklist-based. So in 1980, when the DSM-3 came out, that was the first time that autism and childhood schizophrenia were actually separated as diagnoses, right? So there you can see some of the stage was set for stigma around the name of autism, right? By the time you get to 95 in the DSM-4, you now have autism spectrum disorder, Asperger's syndrome, childhood disintegrative disorder, Rett's disorder, and pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified. When you get to 2010, when the DSM-5 comes out, everything goes back to just autism spectrum disorder. They got rid of Asperger's and the whole nine yards. And so the understanding of autism itself and also the concept of neurodiversity has changed a lot in the last 25 years, and it's continuing to change. But generally speaking, individuals with autism have a deficit in some way, shape, or form in communication. They may have rigid patterns of behavior, stereotype behavior, et cetera. They typically have difficulty with theory of mind, so me putting myself in your shoes and having an empathetic relationship to what you might think in a situation where I don't have all the same data. So, yeah.
And so just to linger on that for a second, because I don't think it's something I've ever discussed with somebody who knows. Like when you think of what's going on in the brain, what does it look like from that perspective? Is there something structurally different about the brains of people with autism? Is it more so developmentally? I mean, we don't have to get too in the weeds there, but just curious.
I mean, the problem is this is a very heterogeneous group of people that are sharing a single label of autism. So at one end of the spectrum, you might have somebody that is profoundly affected, does not communicate vocally or otherwise, may engage in self-injurious behavior hundreds of times per day. And on the other end of the spectrum, you've got a guy that gets called into HR on a regular basis because he's perceived as being rude, right?
Yeah.
So literally everything in between is somebody with autism. And it's because, again, this changing nature of what it is, and it's not a biologically marked diagnosis. It's a checklist. So,
well, I think that leads us into non-binary solutions. So talk about how your background led you to starting this company and the problem that you're addressing with it.
Yeah. So, I was acquired, my clinic was acquired in 2019, and I got to be part of the larger organization that had acquired our group. And it very quickly became obvious that no two clinics, no two organizations do anything clinically the same way. And so I really started thinking about what kind of impact that has and what that does to being able to report on outcomes related to treatment. Because if we're all doing things differently, then that means we can't compare apples to apples. We're all over the place. So I learned about clinical decision support technology while I was in that organization. And when I left there in May of 22, I sort of hit the ground running with starting to make non-binary solutions, which is making that clinical decision software.
So I guess when that clinic got acquired and there's probably more rolled up into a larger play there, that's when you kind of saw, okay, all these other ones that also got acquired, we're trying to figure out how to deploy technology to get them on the same page, and there just wasn't a great solution.
No, not at all. And so, you know, I started thinking about what is it going to take to start to be able to compare data points, and it really just means we have to start standardizing everything from intake to outcomes in terms of how we talk about it, and not standardizing the decisions themselves, but the pathways to the decisions. So at least we have data that we can actually compare.
And your approach with non-binary solutions, so you mentioned taking in data, maybe that's observations. Talk about what that data actually is and how your technology solution is helping that kind of be brought together.
Sure. So the first and easiest way to describe this type of software is to give you an example that you've lived through. So when you go to the doctor and they're asking you all kinds of questions and typing at the same time, they're using clinical decision software, right? It's just nobody has done this for autism and the neurodivergent conditions yet, right? So the software, which is called Noetic, it's got multiple models within it, and it's a sequence of models to standardize the process again, right? So the first model is a care navigation model, and it's asking questions as an interview with the parent or caregiver or the person with autism to understand who is this very specific person coming into your care. What is their unique history? What are all their diagnoses? Have they gotten all their diagnoses? And it builds out a treatment pathway and recommendations for immediate action based on how you answer all the questions. It's a very dynamic model.
Got it. And talk about getting it off the ground. You know, building a product is hard when we spoke on the phone. Yep. You know, you've been through several kind of iterations and thought patterns on how to bring this to market. So walk us through those, because I think a lot of our audience, you know, wants to build a product one day. Walk us through that process and how you've learned along that, and we can dig in a bit.
Yeah. Building two clinics was a lot easier than doing this, because I didn't have to go out and raise money first to make a thing. So raising money, that's a different talk show. We'll come back to that. Building the product, we took a sort of a two-track approach to getting this thing to market. So we were able to get early customers to pay us to make them beta models, which didn't even exist yet, on a low-code platform, right? And so we used that low-code platform to build out the wireframes that I had already put down in a basic format. With those early customers, we were able to get lots and lots of feedback. Will it do this? Can it do this? Why did you ask this question? Shouldn't you add this question in there as well? And so with a low-code platform, we were able to quickly iterate, right? Didn't have to break anything, didn't have to recode anything. And so we've gotten all kinds of research and development through those early partners. And so about 4 months ago, we started the planning process with the development team. Spent a solid 3 weeks planning everything from soup to nuts so that we knew where we were going when we started the SaaS program. And so now that we've gotten all this feedback, we should have our MVP ready in the next 2 weeks.
Of your own SaaS platform.
The SaaS platform.
Outside of, okay.
Yep.
I think that's a really great, smart kind of go-to-market, or not go-to-market, but kind of way to develop a product. You know, start with just, hey, get as much feedback as possible.
Right.
And make sure that you're building something that people are willing to pay for, check.
Yep.
And make sure they're building something that they want to use. You know, it sounds like you checked that.
Yep.
And then it's really important for you to own your own software and have your own software team building it so that you can scale quickly.
That's right.
And so now you're in that position. And so that's really exciting. How have you built your development team? I think that's one thing that when I speak to entrepreneurs that are so early in their journey and they say they want to build an app,
mm-hmm.
you know, one of the first big struggles everybody has is like, well, I'm not a developer.
Right.
So you're not a developer. And how did you get past this, this hurdle?
Yeah. I had built some of these, clinical decision models, during my time in the previous organization. So I knew about the low code apps and things like that. So I knew enough to be dangerous in terms of the architecture, just not completely effective to actually be able to code. And so I was lucky getting into the ecosystem with LaunchBlue and learning some of the folks there and some of the players, some of the helpers. I met other founders. So Dr. Stevens Bonham with Feed Coyote, he and I had a conversation early on. I introduced him to some friends of mine in Paducah, and I said, do you have any recommendations on developers? So he introduced me to my development team. And so for those of you that don't know, Dr. Stevens came from Seattle. He worked at Microsoft. He and this development team had already been working together for a while. So I figure if the smart guy from Microsoft has already vetted these folks, it's probably a safe bet. And then Bob Farinelli, also through the LaunchBlue program, he became a sort of a technical advisor. And he introduced me to Robert Beer, who was his project manager for Smart Farm. And yeah, Robert's had all kinds of experience with building SaaS, running the project management, running their own development team. And so he's become our CTO and is sort of running translation between my clinical vision and the actual coding with the team.
And talk about on the other side of this, so like building the brand and kind of this network of people that are going to, you know, you're trying to figure out who your customers are by going out and you're doing a lot of public speaking engagements. You're building this brand online.
Yeah.
So talk about your approach to that. It's unique. And I think it's fun to watch. I mean, you do it in a very different way. So talk about how you approach that and why you approach it in the way that you do.
Yeah,
and
I mean,
what that means to the business.
The good news about me is that I'm authentic, so I don't have to like fake much of what I do. And it's a lot easier just to do it that way. I've been speaking publicly for 25 years and speaking to the constituents of the therapy that I'm in, right? So I'm 25 years in industry. I basically am invited to run my mouth a lot to exactly the people that will be buying the product. And so I get to evangelize. And so, yeah, I think people are excited that there's a new technology. I'm a trusted brand as a clinician. And so I think that all matters. And again, it's a flywheel.
Yeah. Talk about the pitch competitions. It's been a thing that you've done. I've pitched at Awesome Inc. and several others, Render. What has that meant to your business, and how do you view that in the grand scheme of things when it comes to building a business?
Yeah, I did Awesome, the Five Across last February, I think it was. I got crowd favorite, which I thought was more valuable, frankly, than just winning the judges, because it tells me that there's a desire and an interest from a larger group of people. And so that was helpful just as a first pitch competition. I recently went out to Anaheim, California, and did the innovation and testing pitch competition out there. That was a room full of 500 people and some pretty incredible judges. And I won both the judges and the crowd favorite for that one as well. I was the only female founder. I was the only American. I got great applause when I went from my slide about here I am as a founder and here's all my clinics and, you know, I've got 25 years in industry. And then I switched the slide to my team and I say, and if you're worried about me being a female founder, here's my gaggle of white men to legitimize me. And so the whole room erupted for that one. And the judges even requoted it when we got back around to the Q&A at the end. So I think it made a point, right?
Yeah.
I got to say, no kidding. It's 2% of all venture capital went to female founders in the last 3 years, right? Do you think that's a statistical anomaly or do you think that maybe something's going on with bias? And so, yeah, I can use humor to sort of make my point at the same time, right?
Yep. We'll talk about fundraising. You use a good bridge there.
Yeah.
You're in the middle of it. You've gotten some investment. You're struggling on the other as well. You know, everybody around Kentucky seems to struggle. There's a lack of capital. I think investors around here, you know, they struggle to keep up with the coast as far as, you know, the norms, mm-hmm. the standards of what we're used to on the coast. And so walk us through kind of your experience. I just went through it. I'm going through it now. Mm-hmm. We can riff on it because I think that's a topic that, you know, many in Kentucky want to hear more of because many are frustrated and want to kind of share their experiences?
Yeah, I mean, thank goodness for some of my early individual angels, because that really sort of started the traction, like people that just cared. And again, because autism touches so many people, it's not hard to find somebody that's got a little bit of investment money that wants to help try to get this technology off the ground and sees that this is not my first rodeo, right? Like, I'm a seasoned founder. I've done this. I've put things to scale before. So thank goodness for the individuals. The groups, the angel groups here, I don't think that they really behave like angels. I think some of the requirements, some of the diligence, some of the expectations on traction is well beyond a pre-seed. And that's been really difficult to wrestle with.
Agreed. Yeah. I just went through that. You know, they're expecting, like you said, more traction than what is normal at a early pre-revenue. You know, if you're a business and you're in your early stages, you know, that's one of the great things about the coast is there's really early stage money. Right. And I think, you know, the money here is a little bit more conservative. So the valuations aren't there, but also they're wanting more traction. And they also just don't have really, I think, a great investor mindset. Many of them, you know, there's also obviously great angels around here, but, you know, I think there's a collective mindset around here where they don't move as fast either. And they've got kind of processes in place to get in front of these angels because, you know, they might be like volunteer. They say I'm volunteer angel.
Right.
Like, what does that mean to be a volunteer investor?
Right.
Like, what is that?
Yeah.
You know, so they have these like weird mindsets around in order to get in front of us, here's what you need to do. And we're volunteers, so we're not able to move fast. And that's a lot of the angels around here. And
yeah,
I've noticed that. And I think that, you know, they, at some point there's going to be this critical mass of founders that, you know, are getting good experience and they just start leaving for the coast.
That's right.
And then they're going to start looking around at each other and say, why wasn't that deal brought to me?
Right.
Well, it's because when I went to you all, you put me through some random process and, had multiple gatekeepers mm-hmm. and didn't approach me like a human being.
Right.
And of course I'm not going to talk to you when the angels on the coast get back to me in a week with a check.
Right.
And so it's just different mindset. And I think founders around here, you still have to go through that process because there's just not much capital mm-hmm. and learn and push through it. And it prepares you for the coast. And so
yeah.
I've been talking to a lot of founders lately on how they approach this. And it's kind of sad that a lot of the founders that have experience, they'll tell you, use the local angels as practice.
Yeah.
Use them as at bats and just get experience pitching them and don't take them seriously and then go to the coast. That's what a lot of founders are saying that have been there for, you know, multiple times in a row and have raised, you know, capital, real capital. So I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah. I mean, I can definitely do that math. That makes sense. I'm trying to think. Just some of the feedback. Again, it's they're looking for a set checklist that they have in their mind about all the things that the boxes you should tick for them to be de-risked enough for them to put in this investment. And it's like, okay, I'm bringing you, rather than I've got X number of users on my SaaS platform so far, I'm bringing you evidence that people are paying for a thing that doesn't even exist yet. Like, they're paying for me to develop the product.
You got pilots, you got people paying you early because they're excited.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And it's like, that's worth more than a bunch of free users on a platform. So you got to reverse engineer some of your thinking here. It's like, entrepreneurship means improvisation, right? It means that you're thinking outside of the box. So if you're just going back to some other SaaS platform and repeating and rinsing whatever they did to get to their first check or whatever, somebody else can do that too. And so you've already been in competition with yourself.
It's hard to have really black and white rules in early stage investing.
Yeah.
And I think that's what a lot of people around here have.
Yeah.
And I think that when you go again to the coast and you talk to angels there or syndicates or funds that invest in early stages, there's no necessarily really strict criteria. They're looking at the founder.
Right.
They're looking at the founder team. They're looking at the market opportunity.
Right.
And the investors around here, they don't approach it like that as much. And the other thing about investors around here is that they're not necessarily from industries that are highly innovative,
right,
where venture capital makes a lot of sense. And so many of them come into venture capital because they have had success in more legacy industries that are not highly innovative or scalable.
That's right.
And then they come into this new world of highly scalable, very innovative, very fast moving startups, and they just don't translate very well.
Right.
And so that's where this mindset comes from. And I think that that is one of the issues around here that, again, we have to deal with, and we have to, you know, try to mold to their needs as much as possible. But my advice to founders is just get to the coast and get outside of Kentucky as quickly as possible.
Yeah. Well, my hope is that you and I and a few other good people can get a big 10X and come back and do it the right way. So
That's right.
Yeah. That's what we always talk about, is getting that flywheel going, where you have an exit that puts capital into the ecosystem, creates angels that understand the process, and then it grows from there. But it's just a long process.
Sure.
Back to the business. Let's talk through some milestones and successes, as well as challenges that come to mind. So starting with some of these milestones and successes, what are a few that come to mind that you're particularly proud of?
Well, the fact that we've got this MVP SaaS product coming out in the next couple of weeks, that's a big thing. And the fact that we worked very hard to get it done so that it happened in April, which is autism month. So I think almost just under 2 years old, getting that thing, I think that's pretty exciting. Really excited to have Robert, our CTO. He's been wonderful to come aboard. You know, he splits time between being sometimes in Denver, Colorado, but most of the time he lives in Frankfurt, Germany. And he, once he started working with us, and he was, you know, sort of working as a consultant initially, and then he started to see the big picture, he knew just how big the thing actually was. And he got really excited, and he flew over here to the United States and lived in my Airbnb in my basement for a month and a half, and we became partners, and it's been awesome. I like to describe Robert as if Spock was a Muppet, because he's like super hyper logical and like really animated at the same time. So he's a perfect CTO.
I love that. Well, how about some challenges that you've learned from, challenges or failures, if there are any that come to mind that you think you've had some good learnings from that you'd like to share?
I mean, the biggest challenge absolutely is the fundraising, no question in my mind. Other than that, I mean, I think anything that's been a point of feedback, I've taken it, I've absorbed it, I've pivoted, moved on. Nothing's really slowed me down that much. So,
however, you give some advice on, I think we can dig deeper on this idea of using customer feedback. Mm-hmm. So talk about maybe some of the workflows and processes you've put in place. So for instance, one that I put in place on my previous business, Simba, and the current one is I'll take as many customer calls as possible, record those, translate them with the transcripts, go through them as a team, take what we translate, move it directly to roadmap. Very, very tight feedback loop. Yep. So that was one that I tried to create in my organization. Have you created some in yours that have allowed you to move quickly and make sure you're building something they care about?
Yeah. So Robert, we're sort of building out the idea how to scale as we hire out the team by using Robert's metrics. So he's got these five customers currently, and then he has a weekly cadence call with them, just 30 minutes to see how things are going, get more feedback. And so as we get, you know, 10, 15, 20 customers, we'll incorporate all that feedback and hire a new hire, take that caseload over to that new person. Robert can then keep moving with the rest of the pipeline. So that's sort of our initial thoughts about how we're going to scale and continue to get the feedback, because people will say more in a conversation than they will by sending you an email or, you know, having a feedback form of some sort. So we like to just sit down and have a talk.
100%. If you can get, you know, either when I say face-to-face, even on a video call, and just have a conversation with somebody, you're going to uncover a lot more nuggets than if you were to just say, hey, in an email, what'd you like, what'd you not like? All right, let's move on to the section of the podcast where we try and pull advice out that we can share on social media. So this section is meant for trying to give it advice in as concise of a format as you can.
Okay.
90 seconds-ish. If you go over, that's okay. That's okay. Okay. All right, first question here. If you had one piece of advice that you could give to an 18-year-old that thinks that they'd like to be an entrepreneur, what would it be?
Be white and male.
That's great advice. The stats line up with that.
There you go. No. advice for an 18-year-old, cultivate resiliency. Like, you are going to have to get used to failure, and that's what actually produces success. It's not how many times you get knocked down, it's how many times you get back up.
We just talked about that. I mean, we interviewed Stevens last night, and we talked a lot about that, because he brought up, you know, he's struggling with fundraising as well as just so many people do. It's one of the most, it's one of the hardest, it's not fun parts of being an entrepreneur. And one of the things about it that makes it so hard is you talk to 100, one of them say yes, or maybe five of them say yes. And so that's either 99 or 95 times you're getting told no. And it's not just fundraising, it's recruiting. Uh-huh. It's you're going and trying to build a team, and most of the time they're going to say no. It's sales. It's early sales.
Right.
And most of the time you bring it to somebody and they either tell you that they don't understand it, which sometimes is more painful than a no.
That's right.
And you just constantly are getting hit with what you don't want to hear.
Yeah.
And so it's almost like when things do go well, you're like, something's about to break. Something's about to blow right. up. And you just don't want to get too excited.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I'm going to be excited for 10 seconds. And then I'm going to go right back into the mode where I'm like defending myself.
Right.
And that takes a mental toll on founders that is needs to be talked about more, because it bleeds over into so much of your normal everyday life. And so when you're in that mode of, I'm not going to let myself get too excited when things go right, when it comes to my professional life, the same thing can happen in your personal life, and it bleeds over.
That's right.
Have you experienced that?
Yeah, I mean, I've gotten better at it with age. I can tell you that my routines keep my mental health in check, you know, exercising, prioritizing sleep, drinking water, also some vodka, you know, so everything in balance, right? But yeah, I have definitely had the ups and downs and had things affect my personal life. And so, yeah, it's all feedback. I've got oodles of data, so.
Resilience.
Yeah.
Love it. All right. Next one. What's the biggest risk you've taken that's paid off?
I think, I think the pitch competition, that was completely outside of my industry. Again, I think it was a way of showing validity to what we're actually building, that there's a whole other audience that has nothing to do specifically with autism or applied behavior analysis. Is that yes, that looks like something that we should pay attention to. And it's created other conversations about use cases and marketing, other types of business development and other partnerships that we're looking at. So I think just stepping one big step outside of the circle of the people and the networks I already know is going to be the biggest payoff.
I like that a lot. I mean, broadly, it's just stepping out of your comfort zone, but putting that into practice, stepping out of your network comfort yeah. zone and putting it out, you know, in front of people that might not be super familiar with the problem that you're addressing.
That's right.
And figuring out, how can I communicate this to people that might not have context.
That's right.
On what I'm solving. I think that's a really good one. All right. Last one here. Then we'll quit putting you on the spot for, for quick advice. What's one piece of unconventional advice that you stand by?
Let's see. I don't know. I think just being authentic, I think is the biggest thing. People can smell bullshit, you know, whether it's online or in person, mm-hmm. right? Nobody wants to be around it, and you're afraid it gets on you. You don't want to get around it. So, I mean, I think figure out who you are and be that, and be the best at it that you can be. So.
Yeah. You know, that might come across to people that listen to that. It's like, oh, well, yeah, you hear be authentic, but I think the unconventional part of that is, like, if you're truly being authentic, that can mean so many different things to so many different people. But back to, you know, not bullshitting, basically.
Yeah.
I think that's 100% right. Anytime you're not being yourself, you're trying to mimic or pick up from other people.
It's one of my values, both personally and part of the values of the company, is to be somebody that I needed to see when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. Like, so be that authentic person, be as weird and gay and audacious as I possibly can be.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. Love that.
Yeah.
Now let's think about where Non-Binary Solutions is going. What's the big vision? So when you think 5, 10, 20 years in the future, what's that thing you're aiming for?
Yeah, I mean, I want to get a product out into the world that changes outcomes and quality of life for people with neurodivergent conditions and their constituents. And I want a big fat 10x return. Both things are true. Hashtag it's not binary, right? So I can make something that changes the world, and I can also reap the benefits of that for my stakeholders and myself.
I think that's one thing that, you know, it's entrepreneurs and I think the general public is hesitant to talk about, because it's almost like this stigma that has happened to entrepreneurs, because now we just look up to the ultra, ultra successful ones that are multi-billionaires, hundreds of billions, and right. Society has started to want to tear them down.
Right.
Bezos, Gates, Zuckerberg, Musk,
Elon,
all,
yeah.
You know, to your yeah. point earlier, all white males.
Yes, thank
and
you.
And so it's hard. Not, who's your favorite female billionaire entrepreneur?
Oh, I can't think of one. It's like asking me if what my favorite color is at this
point.
What's
the Bumble founder? I can't remember her name.
Became a billionaire. Or the Wall Street, Huffington.
Yeah.
Ariana Huffington is another one.
That's a good one.
Yeah. But anyways.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Society likes to tear them down because they've made a lot of money.
That's right.
You know, you can both want to change the world, to your point, and make the world such a better place and bring great solutions to the world. But there has to be a side of entrepreneurship, because we live in a capitalistic society, which is what makes America mm-hmm. one of the greatest countries in the world. Is like, that's part of our fabric. And that means people want to make a lot of money. And that's what entrepreneurs, a piece of their motivation is to make a lot of money. It's not, shouldn't be the main purpose, or maybe not always the main purpose. And, it's got to have other purposes and missions, but you have to admit you want to make a lot of money as an entrepreneur.
That's right. Again, it's just not binary. And the idea is that if I have the resources, then I can go out and continue to make better products, solutions, help the people that I want to help. Right. It's all part of it.
Yeah. You provide value.
Yeah.
People want that value. People pay you. You make a lot of money.
That's right.
And I just wish people wouldn't look so down on, I mean, it's gotten extreme, right? I mean,
it's gotten extreme. Yeah.
It's gotten extreme.
We don't need to be taking our own personal rockets to the moon.
Well, we can argue on that. I like the space movement. I like space. But, you know, I wish more people talk about that side of entrepreneurship, because it destigmatizes the want for many people to do great.
Yeah.
And I think just doing great leads to great wealth.
Well, I mean, yeah, if I'm out here raising money and I'm telling investors that I'm going to build a product, they're giving the money and the expectation that I'm going to do something good with it. And that means that there's going to be a return on the investment for everybody. So it's all part of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, one of the purposes of doing this podcast for us and having entrepreneurs on, you know, we want to spread awareness and we want to talk about, you know, what you're actually doing and how you're doing it and spread learnings. But one of the other things is, anybody that's listening, if they want to help, tell them how do you need help? I know you want to connect with investors. What other ways that somebody's listening could they potentially help?
Just continue to talk about what we're doing. Go to nonbinarysolutions.com. Go to noetic.ai. Excuse me. You can follow me at amandaralston.com. On LinkedIn, I'm vaguely professional. On Instagram, I'm somewhat authentic. On Facebook, I'm absolutely unhinged. So, just come be a fan, you know, come follow what we're doing and talk to other people. I guarantee you, if you stand in a room and say, how many of you know somebody impacted with autism, over half of the room is going to raise their hand. It's literally just that common at this point. So help us.
Awesome. Yep. All right, Mandy. Well, thanks so much for coming on. We're going to be cheering for you as you continue building this company. And we really hope you get that 10x return, maybe even 100x. Let's go for bigger.
Thank you so much, guys. It's really fun to be here with you.